This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the stage of history.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, 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 it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Hello and welcome to episode 77 of DreamPod, the Dreamcast Junkyard podcast. We recently celebrated 5 years of the pod, so congrats to everyone who's been involved over the years, and a big thank you to everyone who listens. A huge thanks also to the man himself, Tom Charnock, without whom all of this wouldn't be possible. This year we're also celebrating 15 years since he founded the Dreamcast Junkyard, so thank you, Tom, for bringing us all together for the love of Dreamcast. I'm Andrew, and today I'm flying solo. Well, not quite. We have a very special guest with us. It's not often that we get to speak to someone who had a hand in creating one of the top Dreamcast games from back in the day, but today we absolutely have that pleasure. I'm talking about a game that came 25th in our 2016 poll, which is amazing considering that it was an EU exclusive. Stealth, gunplay, and motorbikes feature heavily in this third-person action-adventure game, published by Sega in late 2001. I'm of course referring to the excellent Headhunter, and joining us is one of the producers of that game, so please welcome Stefan Holmqvist. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Oh, I must say there's a lot of numbers. 77, 15, and 20, and there is some time since Headhunter, so I feel a bit of pressure on me, but I hope I will deliver some interesting facts and battle stories here.
I'm sure you will. Yeah, it's an interesting game as well, Headhunter. I mean, we'll go into it as we kind of talk through how it came to be, but it straddles a weird line of being one of the only kind of Sega released games that wasn't an arcade release, and also it kind of was one of the very last games to be released for the system, and an EU exclusive as well. Mm-hmm. So it's I think it garners a lot of interest from the Dreamcast community, even today. So yeah, it's a fantastic game. So before we kind of go on to talking about Headhunter and all of that stuff, what we usually do is kind of discuss what games we've been playing lately. Usually I steer away from that, but I'm going to stick with tradition this time and kind of ask you what games you've been playing recently.
Yeah, first of all, I haven't been so much into gaming the latest years, but it was actually just more or less 2 years ago through Switch and everything. So I don't know why really, but in the end I managed to, I think it was just before Christmas, to buy a second-hand 3DS. So I have actually been playing a bit of different 3DS titles, and the latest one was Zelda, A Link Between Worlds, that I played just a few weeks ago.
Nice. How did you find that?
Yeah, first it was interesting because, I mean, it was a bit of a history return because it's like a revamp, you can say, of the old Link to the Past game. So again, and I don't know, maybe it's already 10 years old or so, but I felt it's still interesting how, I would say, such an old format still seems to hold up well again. And it's not about the improved graphics. It actually reminded me again how important storytelling and gameplay is actually in a title. Mm,
absolutely, very true. Out of interest, do you still have a Dreamcast lying around? Have you played the Dreamcast recently, or has that been a long time for you?
Actually, I think it's about 5 years. So what happened was, which was simply, I started at a game company called King. That's the company who made Candy Crush. And in my team, there was actually one guy who was a super Dreamcast fan, I found out. And when he heard I was behind of Headhunter, I actually needed to sign a copy. And I actually gave away my Dreamcast to him, and all the purples, everything I got. I had quite a lot of VMUs and everything, and I felt that I didn't need it. But I kept. I still have my copy of Headhunter, of course. One copy left.
Of course, yeah. You've got to keep that copy of, you know, if you kind of made a game, you've got to keep a copy of it, right? Yeah. You must have, like, at least one copy of any game that you've made, surely.
Yeah.
That's cool. So 3DS, I think I picked up 3DS last year, I think it was, kind of middle of last year. So I've played a few bits here and there, but I think the Switch has kind of taken over for me recently. I've been playing the Switch a lot. And a game that I've been playing recently, I don't know if you've heard of it, is one called Grip. Mm. Which is like a racing game, a Grip Combat Racing, is called, and it's it was funded on Kickstarter, and it's very much a spiritual successor to the Roll Cage games that were on PS1. Mm. So it kind of went on sale fairly recently. So me and a few of my friends have bought it and have been playing it. It's very, very fun. It's not perfect by any means, but it's a real old school racing game when you've got weapons and the courses are a bit crazy. So yeah, it's a really interesting game. The fact that the kind of cars can kind of turn any angle, they can go upside down, you can kind of flip them. It's a really fun game to play. Definitely worth it. It was only about £9, I think. So it's a pretty good bargain, really.
Yeah, for sure. I have a Switch. I'm going to check it out. And it's a bit funny. Maybe you see that my first, I would say, the first game I made that I actually got paid for doing stuff was actually a racing action games for the Sega Mega Drive that was called Combat Cars. I don't know the similarities, but again... A small fun coincidence that you bring up this car action game.
Wow. So that's the first game was a Mega Drive game that you worked at. And was that with Amuse? Is that right?
No, that was actually before. It was for, it was a small Norwegian gaming company around, I think it was 91 or 92 or so. And actually some of the people there that I befriended followed through and was part of the founding Amuse, the company that made Headhunter.
Sure. I said Amuse, but obviously the Amuse didn't get founded until 1996, by which point the Mega Drive was kind of like, you know, that was when the Saturn was out, I suppose. So exactly. Yeah, that wouldn't have been. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're kind of coming into that, I guess, now into what... And what was it all about? What happened? How did you get started? So I guess that's my first question. As I say, it was kind of Amuse started in 1996. Mm. You're based in Solna in Sweden, is that right?
You mean the company, or
yeah, the company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's like a small semi suburb of Stockholm.
Oh, okay. Mm. So you were just on the outskirts of Stockholm. That's awesome. Mm. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how aware you were of other developers at the time, but I think Amuse was one of the only European companies kind of making big Dreamcast games like this, I believe. So especially for Sega, I think you're possibly one of the only ones that Sega kind of published games for. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, at that time it was called those... one and a half party. It was like not first party and it was not third party in that sense. So I think it was us and then Bizarre Creations, like Metropolis Race Racer. So, and that was actually a choice. We really put in a lot of effort. We really wanted to make something for that, at that time, next gen console. So we more or less wooed Sega with not at the beginning Headhunter, some game concepts, and because probably we really was into, I would say, Japanese game companies. We felt at that time they were, it was a bit, I would say, I'm not saying different world, but you have the PC gaming at that time, it was not even accelerated graphics, and then you have the console that was more like arcades. We were huge arcade fans, and of course we wanted to go big or start big. So approaching Sega was already at start our goal, our strategy.
Was that your strategy from the get-go then, when the company formed in 1996? Is that where you started? Was the ambition to go for a company like Sega and develop games for them?
More or less. I mean, in the beginning, we was actually just starting and planning to do something more on the Saturn. And on the PlayStation. Still, we were more at this time Sega fans, because at that time, Sony was not considered a real games company. I mean, it was very new. And we were in negotiation with Sunsoft about the title. And when that fell through, was also at the time where the so-called IT bubble or IT started to grow with internet and everything. So all in that, while we were thinking of what to do, thinking of building our game tech, we, as a company, we did a bit of what do we call internet freelancing to go by, to get in a bit of what we say capital to run the company. But then we started, I think, already in more or less when we heard about Dreamcast. So there was a period where we talked with Sega, and it was more until, I would say, 99, actually, when we, if I remember correctly, when we struck a deal, when we signed with Sega to start doing Headhunter.
And so you mentioned before Headhunter itself was the idea. There was a number of other ideas that were kind of either in development or getting thrown around. What kind of game ideas did you have? Were they very similar to Headhunter, or was it very different in terms of different genres?
I would say it was very different. At that point, also remember, we're talking when we're starting the idea here. We're talking about like 97. This type of narrative games had really not been done. Apart from RPGs, it was not so much. So, and we were very arcade influenced. So our first take was actually, I would say, a kind of 3D based Contra. I mean, this type of run and gun shooter with story, what we call influences, which we build the tech and around. The closest I would compare that today would probably be some kind of even more arcade-style Gears of War. And at that time, when we approached that with some tech and concepts, Sega wanted to get, I would say, they wanted actually to have less arcade titles for their system. That was actually part of their strategy of games like Shenmue and everything. Problem was, of course, that they internally, they didn't have any real experience with this type of story. And because of they were very strong themselves, we were a new, small, super small Swedish company with a little track record of some 16-bit games. And they, of course, didn't want to risk or put in a contract with what they said was more like a Contra arcade title. So they declined that. And at the same time, games like Metal Gear and everything started to do. So we did a little sneaky way. We actually over, I think, just a period of a month or so, got some ideas. And then the lightning hit us. And we more or less noted down the whole concept of Headhunter over a weekend. And then we took the assets and the tech we had and reworked that into a new I would say tech demo for something that was a lot similar to what Headhunter would end becoming.
So you kind of mentioned that you started with potentially a game on the PS1 and Saturn. Was that kind of your original idea, or was that something completely, you know, the kind of Gears of War, arcade Gears of War idea? Was that what you were looking at that time, or was that, did that come later to more towards the Dreamcast era?
Yeah, at first it was actually even a bit more simpler. But yes, I would say the original concept was actually that. So you can say that from 96 to 99, we tried to pitch this through different publishers and realized that as a small time was going by, and we felt that should we really try to push it to this generation? We also saw that what we really wanted to do, even with its action title, was really hard to do on a PS1 and a Saturn. And because we also had opportunities, or I would actually say was a bit by the necessity to do a bit of other freelancing work, we said, okay, let's try instead to be one of the first. Let's try to go for the next generation. And let's try to go directly with Sega. And that took a little time even. Like I said, it was only in 99 we actually struck a deal. But I guess that's what the strategy we aimed for, and we were really small, and we managed to survive, and we were stubborn. We didn't want to, like say, sell out to do some smaller game. We wanted to try to get our vision true.
Which is very, you know, in those days, trying to get a big publisher like Sega or Sony to kind of notice you and take your idea on board. It's a big deal, because, you know, it was that they were big players back then. So that must have been like, to approach Sega, was that a difficult thing to do, or were they quite open and welcoming to you when you approached them with the idea?
Yeah, I think from their point of view, they were open, because I mean, they have a lot to prove themselves. But I think from their point of view, and I'm guessing now, they see this one or two guys coming from this small company that they don't know a lot about. They have done some console games before, and they push a lot of ideas. At that time, we also had a little venture capital to support us. So I think from Sega's point of view, they had also, at start, let's say, it very little to lose. They wanted just to listen in, and they did, I would say, rather small investments. And I think that was also a bit of risk we were aware of. Our venture capitals was a bit like saying, is Sega just taking you because you, at start, doesn't request so much funding from them? It might actually be true that, I would say, in some part, we went pretty far into pre-production before Sega really did a financial commit. So that could be, like we say, the middle ground. I think if we would have gone harder and pushed for full funding at start, then probably Sega would maybe not have jumped into that.
Just out of curiosity, before we kind of move on to the development of the game itself, with your kind of initial ideas and initially with Headhunter, were there any working titles for kind of the game before, you know, the ideas that turned into Headhunter, or was there like a working title for Headhunter itself?
I don't think we had... I think Headhunter come up pretty quick when we did this turn. So again, to confirm that, I think a lot of the core mechanics, a lot of the core ideas and everything cemented pretty quick when we needed to, okay, what can we do to salvage the old project when we saw that Sega was not interested in the arcade style game. And we also were really inspired by games like Resident Evil and Metal Gear. I mean, it shows pretty obviously that it that was huge inspirations. And there was a lot of things, I will get back to that later, that was not fleshed out or hurdles we stepped on the way. But if I would look on those 3-4 sketches on paper, it would still be pretty similar to what the end product was.
Kind of moving on to kind of your role, you were the producer, one of the producers of Headhunter. So what was your involvement like in the actual production of the game? What did you do, you know, throughout? What was your role?
So first of all, like we said, the first, before Until the Sun and everything, we were quite few. I mean, we grow from practically 2-3 people to around 10, I would say, 10-15. So we had. So the role in the beginning was a lot of chatter. It was like, to be clear, it was me and another guy, John Crookness, who founded Amuse. So we were two founders. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of things was just founding, negotiating with Sega, trying also to I would say, keep the small, the venture capitalists happy to see that things were actually going forward. Mm-hmm. My role was, I would say, a bit more on the, I would say, gameplay and technical side of production. Not so much on the actual, I would say, storytelling side. Like, as a person, my original work before was graphic artist. So that is my core. Today, people in game development would probably put like tech artist or technical artist as my role. So it was about that, assisting programmers, developer, how we actually could make a tech that took good advantage of the possibilities of Dreamcast, also producing the tool set, supervising when the company grew, supervising the artist a bit more, and also communicating with John and the other people that were more focused on, I would say, the narrative to see what, to find out what was possible and not what possible. Like everything, we had a lot of ideas that we needed to scrap for both time restriction, but also sometimes for technical restrictions. So I would say a bit more like a technical producer would probably be the best fitting name when the production really started to ramp up.
So lots of like looking at the art assets and how the game itself played rather than the story and narrative side. In kind of looking at it in that way, then what were your initial goals when once Sega had picked you up and you knew you were actually going to be making Headhunter for the Dreamcast? What were your initial goals when developing the game? And was there anything that got cut really early on that didn't kind of make it into the game?
I mean, the simple goal was we wanted to make the best game. That's like we all. And one sub goal was we want to be as good as Metal Gear Solid 2. I mean, that was kind of at that point also. We knew also that during the development that PS2 would come out. That's a completed story I can tell if you want to know more about that. I would say the battle between Dreamcast and PS2 from also Sega's point of view. So we wanted to make a game that was really pushing Dreamcast and being narrative. At the same time, when it comes to cutting out, I would say there was a lot of polish that needed to be cut out. There were things we were not, maybe, I would say, camera system and things. There was a lot of quirks that we were aware of that we still needed to skip on, or maybe we decided to skip, to be fair. If I look in retrospective, maybe before, okay. And we needed to cut up some assets, some small levels. Clearly some boss fights needed to go. There were some planned boss fights that didn't end up. In the game, there is a section called Aquadome. Now, spoilers comes for those who has not played the game. Mm-hmm. And more or less, it's a battle arena for convicts. And that was from the beginning more planned to be a huge underground sub-level where you could walk around and do tasks until the end where the pure boss fight appeared. So that was cut down in scope. Mm-hmm. There is a rather simplistic boss fight with one of the key antagonists that is called, Hank. And that turned out to a simple mm-hmm. quick time event. That was supposed to be a lot more advanced, I would say, real boss fight, and we needed to cut out a lot in the biting section. Originally, we wanted more GTI style with the enemies, not enemies, the people walking around. And one big feature that was cut out by Sega themselves in the end was that originally the plan was to have online motorbiking racing competition gameplay.
Did that get cut out fairly early on, or was that later on, kind of towards when the game was due to be released?
It was a bit before. It was when Sega more or less realized that they're going to throw in the towels regarding Dreamcast. Of course, we knew a little of this, I mean, before it became official. It was already in the talks what's going to be happen. But we had more or less it working. There is even some footage, and I think in some interviews and some gaming magazines at that time, there was images that show it, and basically it was, I would say, you were racing in that in the city towards different goals, where you more or less needed to go to those goals before the other player, and in the end, depending what you did, you collected points. At the end, you got the total point summary, and if you had more than your opponent, you won.
So you were really looking to use the Dreamcast to its fullest, then every feature that you could, I suppose you were looking to integrate into the game, even if they didn't actually turn out to be in the final game.
Yeah, and that was at the beginning, that was a sale pitch, that was Sega wanted, that was going to be a major feature of the game. Mm-hmm. And when they dropped the plans for this type of more online support games, of course we even if it was almost finished, we needed to remove it.
I mean, talking about developing for the Dreamcast, what was that like? What was it like to develop for the Dreamcast platform?
I would say, first of all, there was a lot of people that didn't have a super huge experience. I mean, this was still, even if this was after PS1, it was still, I would say, quite new principles. But I would say it mm-hmm. was still pretty easy. It was rather a lot more similar, I would say, compared to PS2 than if you compare to making a game for console today. It has its CPU, the SU4, and it has its graphic card, its GPU Power VR, which is actually the same tech mm-hmm. that it's powering a lot of iPhones still. I mean, Power VR is the card. The documentation was pretty good. We decided to not use any of the pre-libs that was, because we wanted to squeeze out as much power. So we did most of the stuff ourselves. And we were lucky to have two developers that were really, I would say, hardcore optimizers who had background of so-called demo scene. It's more people really try to push their computers and console to do fancy effects. So I felt mm-hmm. still it was, as today, the hardest part was to educate artists to produce the characters and the backgrounds in a way so it didn't take too much memory, and also that they, I was put it, that they put the power where it needed to not make things too much detail when it was not needed, and to find the right balance mm-hmm. of where we should put the polygons, so to say.
I mean, obviously, you know, you were very closely tied to Sega because they were publishing the game. Did they supply a lot of help and support for the game as you were developing it, in terms of, you know, both the kind of getting the most out of the Dreamcast and also just supporting you as a studio?
I would say, if I remember correctly, not so much. We were very independent, maybe a bit stubbornly independent. I know sometimes where there was some delays and they were offering us, if we wanted, we can use the, like, port the games to the Shenmue engine, and I think we declined that. Maybe there was good reasons also that it wouldn't make sense, but I think it was a little bit of stupid youth pride in that also. So I would say we wanted, ideally what we pushed more from Sega was actually financial support. Like, I don't know if I, yeah, I can mention it now, like the music in the game. It's, I still would say that if I look back on the game itself, the graphics, the gameplay is pretty good, but the music by amazing Rika Jakes is a really amazing soundtrack. And because it was so good, we got at that time a bit stupid idea that, hey, why don't we record it in a real orchestra? Why not get the, like, I think it was the, I might be wrong if it was the London Philharmonic Orchestra. So we managed to squeeze up a quite huge budget chunk from Sega to actually go and record the full soundtrack there.
Yeah, so I think one of the Dreamcast Junkyard crew, Martin, he was looking through one of the official Dreamcast magazines from the time, and there is this kind of, in one of the, I think it's the issue with Headhunter on the cover, which is obviously a bit later on, and this is the UK official Dreamcast magazine, there was an article there about producing the soundtrack. So yeah, it was a full symphony orchestra. It was the London Session Orchestra, I think that was the one. But yeah, it was a fantastic soundtrack. And so you were the ones then who pushed for the orchestra rather than Sega. You wanted that kind of level of production value in the soundtrack.
Yes, or actually, it was actually John Crookness, my business partner. I think he was even more into movies. He, in that sense, he had a very good grand vision that I would say was very ahead of time of game production. I mean, still the cost and, I would say, if you compare around this time and 5-6 years later, it's huge difference in AAA sizing of the games. Still, the teams were a lot smaller before. So he pushed a lot of that when it comes to narrative. And he managed to convince Sega, and it was, I mean, it was recorded also in Abbey Road Studio. So that was just amazing. And we actually, even though we didn't need it, we of course pushed to be able to be there. And I must say that was, I would say, when I felt that I was part of something big and part almost like a rock star was actually when we, just before the recording, we were in the, what we call the soundproof recording booths, and we're looking out through all the orchestra sitting there. And I don't know why, we haven't asked for that, but somebody had made a huge, I would say, cloth or textile printout of the Headhunter logo, or the more or less the cover of the game, that was filling the whole back wall of the orchestra. And then we have, of course, heard the soundtrack a lot before in its digital form. And then Richard starts helping with the director, the recording, and they start playing the first notes of the Headhunter soundtrack. And the hairs in the back of my neck, they just stood up completely. And I felt, God, this is big.
Wow, that is amazing. And the fact they had the big cloth kind of game box art in the back. Where did that go? Did somebody take that away?
It's a good story. No, I would say it's a good question. I know we didn't do it, and I don't know why we didn't do it, because maybe it's stuck tucked up in some old attic or something. Let's find out. Put it on Facebook.
Yeah, we need to find out where that's gone.
I hand that over to you.
Yes, we'll look at, we've got our resident detectives, Lewis and Tom, tend to look into these things. We'll get them on the case. We'll track it down. But that is an awesome story. I can absolutely see why you'd feel like a rock star in that particular moment. That's pretty cool. So I suppose that kind of leads into what it was like to work at Amuse at the time.
I would say it was very chaotic in that sense, both good and bad. I mean, like I said, we were rather young. We also was a bit reluctant to, or maybe don't even understand at that point, to take on more external people for managing the company. So it was a very family feeling. At the beginning, at least, I would not say there was this typical crunch culture. At least it was more of this, I would say, the culture was very similar to a lot of internet startups of this time, where it was still a little cool to work all day there. I mean, and to be fair, maybe that was not always the most efficient way to do. So we talked, we chatted, we sometimes was pretty bad of having real structured plans of where we were going. So for me, and I think a lot of at least the core team in the first 2-3 years of the company, it was a really coming of age story in that sense, both from the company and both for us. I mean, a lot of people were, I mean, the youngest were around like 20, and the next bunch were from, I would say, 25 to 30, with very few exceptions. There was nobody over the age of 30 years in the company.
How old were you when Headhunter was being developed?
That was being developed. Let's see, when it's really started for full in 99, then I was, let me think here now, I must have been 26 or something. Wow. 25, 26.
Awesome. So to have that kind of game that you're developing, this huge game for a massive developer at 26, that must have felt pretty special in itself, I suppose.
I don't think I reflected so much on that. It's more like when I talk with people like you that I reflect that also, like, hey, we actually started this company. We got funding and everything where we were a bit just 22, 23 years old. And but I think we were fearless. We didn't know what was possible and not what's possible. I think the difference compared to today is like if you wanted to start a rock band, which I said you could be very little investment. Today you want to start a game company, you want to do your own indie game, you download Unity, you go Unreal, you go and grab some free assets. It's a totally different entry level. Here we're talking about that, okay, either you buy a game engine, that's a couple say from 300 to 800 euro, or you need to buy a dev kit. It's also 30,000-40,000 euro or pounds. So I mean, it was a lot harder in that sense to do that. And you needed to put a lot more things into, I would say, financing or securing some way of funding.
So it was a big undertaking at the time, and especially for, I mean, you know, as I was going to say, somebody of your age at the time, that was, it sounds like you didn't think of it that way then, but it sounds like it was a huge undertaking and a huge task to get where you got to.
Yeah, and
would that be right in saying?
I would say, and that I would say is a learning there, and learning to all is also that don't take on too much. I mean, I know John who did some, we're more separating managing a company. John, he was reading like this Learn Yourself Bookkeeping in 21 Days book while we were doing. So that was the level. But again, it was finally, everybody felt special working with Sega. Especially those things just that we get games and stuff for free from Sega to the game room. You know, we were always playing like Virtua Tennis 2 and other games in the lunch breaks. And good and bad, we, like I mentioned, we were seated a little outside of central Stockholm, around like 10, 15 minutes by the metro. And with other more industrial companies, good and bad, I can felt that was a little also positive because we really kept us in this area, and it felt you were like you had your own little amuse village in that sense. And I would say we grew from around 10 to 50 people fixed in the companies with a bit of externals now and then to assist on some task. I think that's what in general the production force.
Awesome. It's like sounds like a little bubble that you had going on. You were kind of in your own little world and able to create this amazing game kind of without much of an outside influence. So did Sega have a huge influence on how the game development went, apart from cutting the online section?
Not so much. And also saying that Sega has their own, I would say, issues doing that. So we had some producers coming and going because, how can I put it? Sega of America was very little involved in this, and Sega of Europe and Sega of Japan had this, let's call it, parent-child relationship that maybe was not there. Sometimes it was complicated, if I would put it in this way. And so I think we managed quite a lot ourselves, and sometimes it was even I would say, pushing back some ideas from Sega that we didn't fully agree on. But it also was some persons like one of the, I would say, I don't know exactly his title, but I would call still producer from Sega in the beginning, Shimizaki-san, who was really fighting for us and protecting us from Sega. And I am today grateful how much this man helped us out.
So you mentioned that there was some stuff from Sega that they kind of were pushing you to do, but you pushed back and didn't. Was there anything that you can remember that was that they were wanting you to put into the game that you didn't end up doing?
Like I said, just on this part, I was not so heavily involved. But I think it was this usual thing for some producer jumped in. I mean, not the level of in some games, but it's, hey, why? I heard... Look, skateboarding games are cool. Why don't we have a section where Jack can use a skateboarder on the street? It was not this level, but you know, sometimes these small things they wanted, and we try to explain that it would break the concept and it would create a lot of technical difficulties. And then sometimes but can you not try? And then it was hard in a nice way, because also being a Japanese company, you needed to... understand their ways. So I would say not so much from Sega of Japan, but it was more of the, I think some, if I remember correctly, some producer of Sega of Europe who had some ideas that we didn't fully agree on.
So I mean, kind of leads into the next point, which is that, I mean, by all accounts, from, you know, what I've read and what we kind of know in the community of Headhunter, it had a fairly rocky development, I believe. What caused the difficulties that you had? Was Sega a component of that, or were there kind of issues within the company that kind of caused that kind of rocky development?
First, I would say I think the sequel to Headhunter had a lot more body count, if I'm remembering correctly. Maybe, like I say, I'm clouded here, but I never felt that the body count of Headhunter was so... It was pretty stable. It was more like on the final parts where, more or less when the game started to be done, the whole IT bubble has... burst it, and our venture capital company needed to pull out because they have, I would say, bigger problems. Like they invested a lot in some other internet companies wanted to do. So in the middle of there, where we actually are about to finish Headhunter and starting to work and think about the new game, they pulled out and wanted to shut the company down. So in that area, to summarize it, me and John, the other partners, we managed to take some personal loans and secure that we can buy back some of the assets from the other owners. And also we took over some contracts because that was good for them. So they were still tied in some, what you call, contracts for the facilities and everything. So we took on a quite huge risk, and at that point a lot of people disappeared, and we also needed to let a lot of people go, and in the end we cut down to around 15 people and rebooted the company into, it was still called Amuse, but it was technically another, I would say, legal identity. And then from there we tried to start not just the sequel to Headhunter, we also tried to approach Sony on another game concept. And that period was extremely turbulent, and with a lot of body counts and a lot of, I would say, people hitting the wall.
Yeah, I mean, that does sound like a really tough time. And this, so you, just to clarify, this is kind of as the original Headhunter was released and going into the development of the next Headhunter, that's when that kind of all happened, is that right?
Or more, if I correct, I think it was the end of... 2001. Headhunter is complete on Dreamcast. We're doing a bit of effort on PS2, and then they decided to pull out, and we were forced to fire everybody, including me. And then during that period, some people were looking for other jobs, coming still to the studio to look. And the only thing that was left is actually in the old Amuse was 2-3 people. I was not even hired there. It was John and 2 people trying to complete the PS2 port of of Headhunter, because the venture capitals, of course, they realized that it would pull in probably a lot of cash to have Headhunter on PS2. But when that was completed, most of the people were just sitting there. They was not working for the old Amuse. And at the same time, we managed to start up, I would say, the new Amuse, where me and John hired back some key people.
That's definitely a rocky time.
Yeah, it is.
That sounds really tough. I mean, just going back a little bit then to kind of launching Headhunter, the original Headhunter on Dreamcast. Was it rushed at all towards the end? Because obviously this was when Sega had discontinued the Dreamcast in March of that year, in 2001, and you released, I think it was it November you released Headhunter in the EU? I think it was around that time.
Yes.
So was there any rush from Sega for you to release the game once they discontinued the console? Were they pushing you to release it as quickly as possible, or were you pretty much there anyway?
I would say they pushed us. That's what I meant with the polish. It was more like saying, yeah, but right. We want to polish on tweaking. Feature-wise, yeah, we were working on some levels, but I would say the game was complete. So it was more about cutting the planned polish phase. And at that point also Sega itself, like, we could feel it. It was a bit sad in the company that the confidence of Sega was very low at that time. It was... It was almost like the air of the balloon was slowly seeping out. Or there were changes in the management and all that. And I mean, just an example, they had a completely done game and they decide, Sega America, no, we don't want to publish it.
This is Headhunter we're talking about, right? So Sega America just decided not to publish Headhunter over in America, is that right?
Yeah. And they decided to... I mean, makes sense. They're saying we don't want to invest in that. But at the same time, Sega of Europe, I mean, we were porting it to the PlayStation 2. But Headhunter is not released by Sega in America on PlayStation 2. They said, no, we don't want to do it. And why? Silly politicals between the two different locations. So in the end... John actually, through just some networking, found that had a bit of talk, and then somebody in Acclaim said that, yeah, but it looks like a nice game. Why don't you want to release it in America? Can we do it? And at first, Sega didn't want to allow that. So it was like a negotiation, like, come on, drop your pride. We will get money for this. You will get money from it. It will be very little effort. So finally, John managed to sell the idea to Sega of Europe, that got permission from Sega America, that Acclaim of America could release Headhunter on PS2 in America.
There's a lot of politics going on there, isn't there? That's slightly crazy.
Yeah.
They really didn't want to release it at all. And this was just because they there was kind of ill feeling towards Sega of Japan or Sega of Europe from them, perhaps?
I can only speculate. I'm just saying that there was so little reasons, and the reasons felt very constructed. So I can only assume that there must be some internal politics. That's my only, I would say, that's the only thing that makes sense.
I mean, from what I kind of learned of the different divisions of Sega and kind of what you've said as well, it almost, you kind of mentioned that Sega Europe was almost like the child to Sega of Japan, who was the parent. And in that case, it's kind of like Sega of America were kind of like the black sheep of the family. They kind of just wanted to do things their own way, by the sounds of it. And that's possibly one of the reasons, I suppose, that they didn't want to pick up Headhunter, maybe. Moving away from the politics, of which there seems to be quite a lot going on there, back to Headhunter itself. There were quite a lot of live-action news segments in the game. It was ABCBS News, I think. And they added quite a lot to the lore of the Headhunter universe. And also they were quite camp and quite funny. They added a bit of humour. What was it like to produce these? Were you involved in that part of it, in the live action segments?
No, so from the pure production point of view, like I said, it was John who handled that more. We actually used our, Jim, who was one of the voice actors, and for Jack and some others, he had a lot of networking, so we were lucky there to get I think Dominic Gibbs is a guy who has worked with a lot of movie production and everything. The same can be told also by Philip Lawrence, who was one of the writers. That at that point, as again, I think we took a bit different approach. We actually said that, come on, people in gaming, they only know games. We need to look at the people from the movie industry and take that in. That was the same with the music recording, with all that. So we actually partnered with some people that had, I would say, TV level production values. So we needed to rely on them, and we got a lot of good input. I think that was one of the great things, that we actually didn't just be our, let's call it, incestuous group of people who wanted to make games and have played games, but we also had people who were came from outside, who was not even sometimes interested in game, and they brought in their perspective to the production. So in the end, they were doing, we set up some storyboards and stuff and everything, and then we handled the production of that out to them, and we got the material back almost fully edited from them. So of course there was a collaboration, but it was also a bit of satellite teams that handled that.
And yeah, you kind of mentioned there was this kind of wanting to do more than just a game. Almost it was that element of wanting the movies, as you know, that's a big influence that's felt throughout Headhunter, really, is you know, kind of action movies. It's very, very heavily influenced there. So was that the plan all along then, to kind of mix these media together to have a game that felt like a film, you know, that felt like something more than a game? Was that the whole point of it?
Absolutely. And like I said, influences, you can see Paul Verhoeven. I mean, half of that is this campy base is very improved with that. So I would say it was like Metal Gear, Resident Evil, Starship Troopers, RoboCop, all those very heavy influences. But we felt like, why not copy and bait it some? Because, come on, there is nothing better in the gaming industry. Again, I mean, look at people who feel like, now suddenly my brain stopped working. And the guy, the guy who made Metal Gear.
Oh, Hideo Kojima.
Yes, of course, Kojima. I mean, look at his stuff, how heavy influenced or copied his stuff is done. There's very little that is original there, but the level compared to everything else at that time was still so much huger.
And is that kind of where you wanted the company as a whole to go towards, to have to kind of create these big games that were, you know, just more than just gameplay? There was the big elements of story and narrative there. Was that what Amuse was going to do going forward? Was that the company vision?
Yes, that was the vision. I think even the vision was stated of like narrative-driven, immersive action games or something. We wanted still, we were still loving arcade and gameplays, but I would say that faded a little at the end. And we needed then at the end to take a direction that was more action related again. But we tried to pitch one concept to Sony, I would say after Headhunter, that was very, very narrative and emotionally driven. I would say that, I'm not going to say anything there, but there, if you're aware of the game called Heavy Rain by David Crane, there is a lot of similarities we had in our concept to that game. Some similarities that are almost irritating, considering we pitched that game some years before Heavy Rain to Sony, that ended up being publisher to that. So, of course, personally, I cannot prove anything, but I always have this little, this pitch document and everything we gave to Sony, did that somehow end up to David Crane? Probably he had very similar concept, and it might be just coincidences, but it was very, very similar in approach. And I would even say that we had a little problem sometimes aligning internally, because to be very brief, there was a section in this game where you're looking for a killer. It's also a detective game in New York with occult appers, and there is one area where there is I think it was a woman buried under the ground, and you come to that area and you need to listen and dig and try to find where she is buried, to dig her up and save her within a time limit before she suffocates. And I remember that in some area we talked and one of the game designers was there. And yeah, and then if she dies, how do we do? Do we take a reset boat so you can replay the section? And I remember me and John saying, what? No, she's dead. Yeah, but then you failed in that section. Yes, like in life, she's dead. But you will be sad as a player. Yes, that's the point. You want the player to feel stuff. So we really was into that type of things. But also at that point, maybe we were a little ahead of time there. And it was hard to make people in the industry understand that it's not just about scoring.
Sure, yeah. I mean, this would have been during the PS2 time, I guess, wouldn't it, when you'd have pitched this rather than PS3?
Yes, that was late PS2. So this must have been, the pitch was, I think, in 2002.
So I'd obviously did a little bit of reading. Was this the pitch for Ozone? I believe that was the title of the...
No, that was later. This was...
That was later?
lot later. That was at the end of the company. So this was before...
Okay.
This was between Headhunter and Headhunter Redemption. At the end, Sega didn't offer us a sequel at the end. It was only a bit after when it was released and they saw that Headhunter sold pretty well. Then they came back and say, okay, we want a second. So I would say that half year, in all this mess of chaotic between the shift of the company, we had this small group who made promotion material and such for this game that the temporary title was called Exor City. And we approached Sony and we even started negotiating, but then we didn't agree on the budget. I think we played very high risk game in many ways here, but we didn't want to do this game unless we felt there was appropriate budget, because even if it was PS2, it was a lot of similarities. We wanted to have more mocap, facial expressions and all that. Continuing the track, we're involving the movie industry more.
To have a game that was basically Heavy Rain back then would have been amazing. And the fact that kind of your pitch ended up being basically what Heavy Rain turned out to be in a lot of ways, that must have been very frustrating when that came out. And I mean, does that pitch still exist? Do you still have the original pitch, or is that kind of long gone now by this point?
I don't think I have that. I think I have some small material, but not there. Also, in defense of David Crane, is to say that the game before Heavy Rain, what was it called again? I don't remember.
Fahrenheit
also had a lot of similarities. So maybe we just like these type of narratives, I would say modern adventure games and horror themes, because there was a lot there. I think that was even more frustrating, because Fahrenheit appeared just some, I think it was some years after we had the pitch to Sony by some other companies. So it was more like, look, they even managed to do a game on PS2 that was similar to what we envisioned.
Yeah.
But, and of course, in our stubborn heads, we said when we saw that, but hey, if we would have done it, it would have been so much better, which we, of course, don't know if it would have been. And that was, I think, when we were finalizing the sequel to Headhunter, when we saw that Fahrenheit game.
That's really interesting to know that. I feel like I'm jumping around here a little bit, but I did want to kind of touch a bit more on the original Headhunter just before we move on a little bit further. But so, I mean, Headhunter is arguably one of the best looking, if not the best looking game on the Dreamcast. It's, you know, it's kind of, it feels like it's pushing the Dreamcast to its limits. Tom, who founded the Dreamcast Junkyard, he wrote a quick look article about Headhunter, which you can read on the dreamcastjunkyard.co.uk. And one of his favorite scenes was the rooftop boss battle that took place in the pouring rain. The lighting effects and the atmosphere, it's just amazing. How important was it that Headhunter looked great, and were you pushing the limits of the Dreamcast by creating that engine and those graphics?
I think it's very important. I mean, both me and John is like, we like with movies and cinema, very, very visual persons. And I mean, one interesting part is I mentioned that when the company grew, I moved more into production and art lead, but I started out doing graphics in Headhunter. I mean, we were, like I said, that Jack is very popular because I think every artist has had the hands on him, the model, the character. But I mean, I started those core first characters was actually, I was involved in that. I modeled the parts of Jack and Grey Wolf. And the Grey Wolf mm-hmm. boss fight was actually the first we made. And that is actually, that is actually I who did it. That's, I think, the more or less, there were some tweaks by another Johan later who did a little improvements. That was really great, adding a little more color. But like I said, I would call myself a tech artist. So all the effects and stuff and setup of the Greywood boss fight is actually my doing.
And it's an amazing fight. It's a great part of the game. I mean, were you pushing the limits of the Dreamcast with what you were doing with that? Was that kind of on the limits of what the Dreamcast could do, or could it have been pushed further potentially with more time?
I think not just more time, but also more time and also more better tools and better understanding for some artists. I would say it didn't push Dreamcast. I think it's also like in all games, it's always easy to say afterwards, you can have squeezed more. Yeah, but it takes too much time. I think that boss fight was easier because, like I said, I was very technical who I made it, and it's also very confined. It's like just this area. So it's like the fake it, especially in Dreamcast and all the consoles, it was a lot more fake it until you make it. Today it's a lot easier. A lot of things were just I can do it super brief. Like there is a lot of nice reflections. There is this it's a rooftop and it's raining and it's evening. And I mean, the clouds in the background was just me having different layers of cloud textures, real photos that was animated. And the floor was just a flat floor where I had a texture where I would say the different pixels had different level of transparency. So it revealed what was under it. And what was under it was just the same geometry copied and mirrored. And in that, it looked like there was reflection in the water puddles, and all the raindrops was just the same. It was just one texture where I had a little small textures with a couple of raindrops that was animated in maybe 4 or 5 frames, and then it was just stretched out and used all over the floor. And suddenly it looks like rain was dripping everywhere. And I added some what we say. It's called particle systems. You can imagine there were small objects that create small objects. And that would added on the top of Jack's shoulder and areas of the game. And it made those small splashes. And to the whole rain effects, I'm very simple. I faked it. I just created a small cylinder of maybe very simple object, and then I took I took a texture of some stretched raindrops that was animated, and I just dressed that cylinder in that, and then I just attached that cylinder around Jack, so where he moved the rain mode, so it looks like it's rain everywhere and it's depth and everything, but that's just a small cylinder around Jack.
That's really impressive. So that, you know, to have accomplished that on the Dreamcast, that, you know, it's, I mean, it looks amazing. So well done for, you know, for having created that on, you know, a console that's, I mean, it's a console that's known for being quite, you know, it's got quite a few good looking games, but, you know, Headhunter was probably one of the pinnacles of, you know, graphics on the system. So, you know, well done for creating such a technically accomplished game on the system. It definitely shows. Kind of moving on from that then, what do you love most about Headhunter? What is it about that game that, you know, thinking back now nearly 20 years later, you know, what do you like most about it? What do you still love about it?
I think what I mentioned, that it pushed things forward. It, of course, other games did it in the times, but it was the vision of having something more like a movie. And I think it does it well or not. Like, it's in the story, even during the development, the story was created changes late. It was super chaotic. So I mean, if we could have been tons better, but I think by involving people and still trying, it is a quiet, nice story. If I compare with the sequel, I for sure prefer the first Headhunter. It copies a lot of things, and what I like is also it has sci-fi elements, but it's also modern. It's a bit this, like, it's about a guy. This cliche Clint Eastwood lone wolf who rides a bike in the sunset of California-style settings. And we mix as a bit of puzzle solving games. It could be frustrating. There is backtracking, but the puzzles work pretty okay. They're also grounded a little in that, and there is stealth action. I mean, maybe that is the weakest point, but it still has some action and a little stealth. So it's not a stealth game, and it's not an action game. It also brings quite a lot of things together in an okay way, not the perfect way, but an okay way. So I think it's a bit like those medium cheap TV shows you saw on late evenings in TV. It's still enjoyable. It's still enjoyable.
Absolutely. I would say it's, you know, for a lot of people, it's more than just an enjoyable game. It was a very, you know, for people who kind of bought into Dreamcast as well, you know, it was a really great game to get that late on into its life. Say that late on into its life, you know, Dreamcast would have ideally gone on for years longer. But, you know, considering it got kind of taken out of the equation in, you know, when they discontinued it, to have a game of that kind of quality and caliber that late on, it definitely has a very solid place in the hearts of quite a lot of Dreamcast gamers, I think. So if you could remake or remaster Headhunter now, what would you change or add or remove from the game, if anything?
It's interesting because, of course, sometimes because it has a, I would say, this talk with you and other interviews can sometimes be therapeutical because it was an interesting journey. And pure personally, if I would redo it today, I would not, of course, improve graphics and ethics and everything. That's natural. So that is not so much to talk. I think story is also pretty fine in that sense. I think it mostly would be down to gameplay. I think I would have just made some of the controls and camera work less, I would say, jittery. I wanted a smoother, more polished gameplay. And I would have wanted to, like I said, add back some of the boss fights and areas where we needed to cut it out. Not because it's really needed, but just because that was the original intention. If there is one section I would have loved to explore, because that is still not done in a good way, not even with GTA, the original intention with the bike was to have a more lively city. It was to have boss fights on the games. It was to have, I mean, the scope of the game was to have the bike section as another type of gameplay. We say we have the stealth gameplay, we have the action, we have the puzzles. The original concept was more or less to have more control of the bike, maybe even have shootouts on the bike and everything. We dropped that because it was really hard of time and we really didn't know how to make that happen. I still don't know how to make that happen today. But can you imagine, a better looking Headhunter with less loading times and tighter controls, a little improvements in some boss fights, and a hugely improved action-based bike gameplay. Wouldn't that be nice?
It would be, absolutely. Yeah, it would complete it, I suppose, wouldn't it? It would make it into, like you say, the game that it was originally intended to be. And yeah, you can tell there was meant to be more with the motorbike sections, for sure.
Yeah.
So to know that there was kind of this huge plan around, you know, not only the online section, but also, you know, having the streets be more alive and have things happen in them, that, you know, having that added to the game would be absolutely amazing. I mean, is that something, if somebody approached you and said, hey, you know, we want to remake Headhunter, kind of remaster it and make it into, you know, a more modern game, would you jump at that opportunity, or is that kind of behind you now?
It's actually interesting because sometimes in general, because of probably previous searches on YouTube and such, sometimes they can pop up ahead on the clip. And of course, I don't watch the clip, but I actually sometimes go to the comments. And when you hear people saying, oh, I love these games, and you realize how much joy and affection you gave to people, then that is sometimes still that makes me feel that all the struggles and good and bad was worth it. It really, I can understand people that are creative and get its feedback. It's really heartwarming. And of course, people are talking about, I would say, a remake or even sometimes a real sequel, Headhunter 2. And pure directly, of course, I would love to do that. Of course, I would like to see if there was some other part of the gang to do it. I think the hard part is the reality that, like, first, Sega still owns the IP. That's one of the key things. And most of the people love. I mean, that's huge influences. Like one of the people from what we say, Amuse, I mean, went over to CEO of Avalanche that made Just Cause is from Amuse. Another guy who was the key producer for Battlefield games came from Amuse and is now responsible for Ubisoft Sweden. I mean, we spread it a lot. So, of course, we have our jobs. We have grow older. We have our real life. So that make it, I would say, practically hard because it needed to be substantial financial secureness to jump onto such project. And but it would be like personally, the only way would be that if there was somebody who approached that and say, I work now in a gaming company, so I cannot do it, would be like, okay, you're allowed to take 1-2 years of leave and absence and work just on this game because otherwise you're working with competing projects that you're not allowed. And we saw that there was a budget to do that. Sure. I'm also happy that if there would be anybody who would like to do a remake of Headhunter, I would be glad to that. So it's not just about me because like everything is part of your baby. And of course you want to see that it's could live on for future generations.
I mean, you know, so Sega hold the IP, and like you said, you've got people who've gone to different companies like Avalanche. I mean, Avalanche, their kind of history with gaming, and they've taken on things like the Mad Max franchise.
Yeah.
They kind of made the Mad Max game. You could imagine if Sega and Avalanche could get together and use the IP, that could be a... But that's, I mean, that's the joy of things like of Kickstarter as well, is that there is a lot of projects that have started on there where people have been able to kind of create video games, not just for the... I mean, you know, the Dreamcast community has had that with creating kind of homebrew games, but... Yeah, that kind of project, you'd have to buy the IP from Sega and then, or get them on board with it. And then, yeah, but yeah, I suppose never say never.
I even written that. So from here to you, I'm saying that if there was enough interest from the community that could be gathered in some thread of saying, then of course, personally, there would be a lot more interest to take risk of saying that. But like I said, right now with my private life and everything, I don't have the energy and time to do that that push myself. So it needs to start up from the grassroots need to say, bank and say, we're not just want the Headhunter. Here's money on the table. Now you can do it.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Well, we need to get that started. So we've got a few things to do now. We need to find the Headhunter kind of fabric box up from Abbey Road Studios. We need to start Kickstarter, get Headhunter back. It's there's a lot to do. And I think,
why are we talking? Let's do it now.
Let's do it now. Right, we'll just stop the podcast. We'll get on it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think people listening to this will probably jump on that fact, and I'm sure that some of the people from the Dreamcast Junkyard, the team, would probably jump on that as well. It's a beloved game for a lot of people, so
yeah.
You know, I'm sure there'll be a lot more vocal chat about potentially bringing it back in some form or another. That would be great.
And from a more technical art point of view, I can promise if I would be involved in that, I would personally secure to write the best beard shader for Jack ever made. His beard is going to be amazing.
You heard it here first. Beard shader, amazing, top quality. Let's do it.
Yeah.
let's get Jack that amazing beard. I think one big question, and we did speak about this, me and you, just before the podcast when we were kind of discussing initially, was about Headhunter Redemption. And I know that you're not particularly happy with that game. What was it about Headhunter Redemption that you kind of weren't happy with?
I think I'm not speaking about the production. If I look just on the game, I find a lot of the controls and stuff is a lot better. Visually, I think it's also looking great, even though I prefer a little bit of the saturated California sunlight. I think it's about the story and everything. I think it's a very different games. I would have preferred Headhunter to be more a continuation, not this gap. I know there was talk, even there were almost, we had like several teams who worked with that. And I remember sketches that I wanted more about, like I said, I wanted to evolve the if we could see to get the bike gameplay more, but like more like take the original Headhunter, push it a bit more to PlayStation 2, and continue the theme, continue the story of that, not pull it into this sci-fi direction, keep it more the same, work more on the gameplay. Like typical, there was some ideas, like I remember the start where it's a bike boss fight with Jack on an airport, where he's like, I'm not saying in Pants and Dragon style, but imagine you, he's like chasing this plane that is trying to lift off from that airport by the bike. So the plane is turning to get enough leverage as he's shooting and trying to do that. But I think there was ideas that the plane was half open and some people were standing outside and trying to shoot Jack. Personally, that was more the vision where I had hoped Headhunter would have gone. So not the redemption, but just a simple, I don't know, like Headhunter 2, California Sunset or something as a subtitle. That was more the theming I would have preferred.
That does sound good, like the kind of the on-rails boss fight almost with shooting and driving sounds pretty cool. It's a shame that didn't happen, for sure. So, and I mean, obviously that the Redemption was released on PS2 and Xbox, so you had, you know, you had some, you'd already developed the original Headhunter, you'd ported it over to the PS2, so you had some knowledge of that. What was PS2 and the Xbox like to develop for as opposed to the Dreamcast? Was it more difficult or a bit easier?
Of course, it was different. What happened was on there is one of the most problematic part was that when we needed to do this, I would say, shift from the old to the new Amuse, we more or less lost the whole tech team. And that's very simple. One of the hard fact why we kept a lot of more artists was that it was hardest for artists to get jobs elsewhere. It was not just because they loved and wanted to stay at Amuse, but for programmers or developers, it was of course a lot easier to, not just in gaming, to go and find another job. So we lost them. So a lot of the knowledge and expertise we got technically was wiped out. And for Headhunter Redemption, the solution was that we actually bought the game engine Renderware, which was awesome. But that was also a learning period to get into that. I'm not saying that if we would have kept the developers and ported and continued the Headhunter engine for Headhunter 2, technically, I don't think that would have been a difference. But it meant that it was still a struggle to learn that tech also. So I would say we didn't probably squeeze out what we could from PS2 either.
I kind of mentioned it earlier, but after Headhunter Redemption, you started work on the project which we know as Ozone, before obviously Amuse closed down. What can you let us know what that was? What was it? What was it about? What was it going to be?
Yeah, basically it was more, I would say, I'm not saying Left 4 Dead, but it was like, it was also inspired by I Am Legend and everything. So it was more like the basic core, it's a zombie game where you play first person and single and together, where it was more like, put it simple, when there is sunlight and everything, the zombies are, slow in the sun, but you're yourself taking damage in the sun. And when you take cover in the shadows, it's more risky because they are there also. So it was this day and night cycle balancing. So the gameplay was lost that you went into an area and you needed to collect materials. It was a bit of crafting, I would say. There's a lot of modern tech there. So the key core is you are having your day or everything where you walk around and you pick items and you build barriers and everything, and then you secure yourself. So you know, in 3 hours I can take cover here, but I need to build these fences because then the sun will move, then those zombies will be so much quicker, and then you could survive through that to the next part of the game. So it was a bit of strategic crafting and collecting first-person zombie action game with narratives was also more driven by first party, a bit more like, Half-Life, like finding hidden stuff, radio contact and such.
That sounds amazing. I mean, I love zombie games. I'm absolutely a huge fan of zombie games, so that sounds right up my street.
I'd
like to have seen that.
We were a bit unlucky there also, and that was based on Unreal Engine, so I think it would have made an amazing game. But unfortunately, what happened was that we had almost signing by Atari, and then it was in negotiation with Egmont, Nordic Film, and there was also a bit of, I would say, happenings for those companies. Atari had a failure on one of their driver games, so they needed to do budget cuts, so In the end, we didn't manage to secure that publisher for that title, and we needed then in 2005 to close down.
So you closed in 2005. That must have been a really tough time for you. You know, it's kind of your company and the kind of legacy that you had. How difficult was that to have to close the company and move on?
It was very emotional. And also, not going to go in deep details, but I and John, we took a lot of financial hit. I can say I got in debt of around 200,000 euro, which is pretty a lot.
Wow.
So I more or less, for around... 5 years almost, not really, maybe four or three, but I more or less isolated myself. I went to some kind of post-amuse depression where I just, I promised myself I will never work with game again, never again. And I did instead, went back to do a bit of graphic design and web design. So I worked with that. But then in 2008 and 2009, iPhone happened and I was pulled into more app development there from the more app and graphic and usability sides. And through that, suddenly you need to tinker a little and suddenly why not test a bit of small arcade games there? And suddenly you find out you're sitting and doing games again. And and then through that, I ended up in 2013 as producer for Candy Crush. At that time, it was the biggest game in the world, with like pulled in $5 million a day in revenue. So that was a bit of journey in a bit under 10 years to go from this company, about 70 people, to more or less doing pizza menus. I will text your pizza menus for food. And then through iPhones up to work with the biggest game in the world again.
That is quite a story altogether. That could be a movie of itself, kind of your story of
maybe I should write it down now when you say that. Maybe that's a book.
Yeah. It's a memoir. I would definitely read that for sure. And you know, Candy Crush is like, I mean, it's still a huge game. There, people still play it, and the different variations of it as well. It's a huge game. So congrats to kind of be working on that kind of level of game again. It must be really nice to have come back and, you know, being able to work on something that was a hit that people really enjoyed.
Yeah, it was, and it was almost purely by luck. It's interesting, and I think I'm not alone on that. When you look at people in the creative industry, how many stuff sometimes the balance between failure and success, and even having success is not a guarantee for a lifelong success. How little that can change things.
So we do have I have a few quick questions towards the end. We had some questions from Twitter, but I just wanted to ask you just lastly, I think that's a word, on the Dreamcast itself. Why do you think it's still such a popular console to this day?
I think because it had great games. I mean, let's not forget. And I think that had a bit of, I think Dreamcast and Sega at that point is also a bit of mix. It's not, Sega was not Sony then. And it was not Nintendo, but it was a little bit of both. And for me, especially those arcade games like Crazy Taxi, Virtual Fighter, you also had Virtual Tennis. It was amazing couch gaming still there. And and you had maybe not so much narratives, but Skies of Arcadia and all. And it was a bit progressive with Jet Set Radio and other type of these more, I would say, Japanese games that still was a bit more modernized. So I think it's loved because it actually, it's a bit like Headhunter. It actually pushed and opened a lot and tried a lot of new things. It did it okay. It didn't succeed. But, I mean, it inspired, I think, a lot of other consoles. So I think it's a nice package.
Well, let's just jump into just a few. I've got a few written down here, but I'll jump into a few quick questions from Twitter. We also have a couple from Martin, who's a Dreamcast Junkyard team member. His first question is, what was the inspiration behind some of the main characters, especially Jack Wade? I think you've mentioned, actually, was it Clint Eastwood?
I think it was a bit sketchy. It's a bit of this lone hero, Clint Eastwood. Then also there is a American, I think it's 90s produced, rather also cheap show called Renegade. It was run by an actor called Lorenzo Lamas from this 80s soap Falcon Crest. So if you Google around and look for TV series Renegade, you will see how much of the concept of Headhunter that it also is brought from that. So I would say Snake Plissken is also from Escape from New York. I would say he's a mix of those 80s and 90s tough guy silent heroes.
He also asks, Martin also asks, why does Jack run with a limp?
Because we never got the animation to be really good. God damn how much argument and fighting we have of that and trying. I say only because we didn't manage to get it look as good as we wanted.
Fair enough, fair enough. He also, his last question is, Stefan, can you ride a motorbike? Can you personally ride a motorbike?
To be fair, I'm even bad at riding a bike, so no.
Fair enough. So I think this is possibly, we've answered this already, but Rick Richardson at Rick Richardson on Twitter asks, I seem to remember the game having endless comparisons and references to Metal Gear Solid in previews before release. Was this something that the team was aware of, and was it a help or a hindrance?
Of course we were aware of it. I would say it was a help because it puts more pressure on it. One thing that is super important to say that we were inspired by a lot of games, but almost mid the development of, Metal Gear actually appeared more or less in the, not mid, but a bit into the development of Headhunter. We had tank controls for Jack quite a bit into the production. And then they released this first trailer of Metal Gear Solid 2, and there is this top section. I mean, to be honest, it's more a top-down game, really, when it comes to action. I really saw some playing, and at that point, remember, apart from Mario, there was not a lot of action games that has that directional control because it was not so easy with the camera. And I said, and I talked with Peter Johansson, who was the game designer. We said, come on, we need to do this. Look how much quicker the game does. So we went to the Christian Sirius, who was the main gameplay the coder or developer, and they were not convinced, but we said, can you not try it? And about 1 hour later, he just made some changes in the code. And instead of going from this rotate left or hold a little to the left and a little to the right, but you could not turn directly quickly, to this directional that you quickly moved and started running to the direction of the pad. And we directly saw, goddamn. And we needed to change a lot of the fighting setups we started on, but that I think was a breaking point. It was like, oh my god, the game is going to play so much better.
So just jumping on, it's a kind of similar question, kind of leads on from it. Fernando Carrero at FER_CN93 from Twitter, he kind of mentions Metal Gear Solid as well, and he said the rumor was that this was going to be Sega's answer to Metal Gear Solid. Is there any truth that Sega saw it that way? Were they looking at it in that way?
First of all, when we started it, Metal Gear Solid 2 was not announced yet. So I don't think... Of course they saw it. Of course they saw it, that there was opportunities. But I never got that was the pressure. It was more of a pressure to ourselves. I mean, at that point, it was more like every time there was an E3 or show, or remember, there was still a lot less... internet was still... more like the magazines. It was more like everything you saw a screenshot of another game that looked vaguely similar to Headhunter. Your heart jumped because, oh my god, another competition. And I think it was the same for all other game studios, that it was less open. So the competition looks always a lot better than it was in the end, and you got scared about that. So I think that was good because I think it pushed us and other teams to actually try a bit harder.
Couple more questions. Rafa Londo at All Tags Finder on Twitter asks, after looking inside the manual, I'd like to ask how the cooperation with Casio, the Casio watch, influenced production, and if there are any other ideas for more product placement in the game?
Not really. It was just an opportunity, and I don't remember it being so complicated. And I don't remember if it was where it came from. It just appeared.
So... an interesting question from CABBAC at official CABBAC on Twitter. Mm-hmm. He asks, I want to know how would Jack cope with the lockdown that we have at the moment, the quarantine?
I think Redemption showed that. I think there is one single word for that. Alcohol.
Yeah, I think that's how a lot of us are coping, to be perfectly honest.
And that you can see that Jack is a tough guy, but especially when you can see in the sequel, he's not the best one to cope with emotional struggles.
One I've got here, at Chips Verdicky, I think that's how it's pronounced, from Twitter, says he doesn't have a question, or they don't have a question. They just wanted to thank you and the team at Amuse for making such a cool game.
Yeah, thank you.
And lastly, Billy Norby, at Billy Norby on Twitter, has asked how your cats are doing. He worked with you on Headhunter 1 and 2, apparently.
Yes. It's interesting, the something. It's also interesting because Billy started out, I would say, as an intern. That's also a bit of the family-based recruitment process, that he was rather young and, what would I say, inexperienced. But during the interview, me and John, we actually saw potential, just because, I would say, we felt he had the right mindset. And he managed to do add a lot into the I would say the gameplay and game design together with Peter for especially was working a lot in the second Headhunter. I would say he is also was my ally, that I think we both I think he was the one who shared my vision as most what we would have done instead with the sequel. And now I don't know if I'm allowed to do that, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's an interesting story. He actually, after the close down, went to America and became a I would say, fantasy and sci-fi fine art painter. So I'm going to promote him and say that if you check for Billy Norby, you will find amazing paintings by him.
I'm definitely going to check that out. For people who are listening, Norby is spelled N-O-R-R-B-Y. So check that out. Have a Google, see what you can do. That's really awesome. Just from me, for the last thing, because you mentioned it a little bit earlier and I'm kind of interested, you mentioned to do with when the PS2, it was known that the PS2 was going to be coming out, and you said there was a bit of an interesting story there. I don't know if you had a particular anecdote for that, or if we've already kind of gone through it.
I'm not going, of course, Sega had their own little identity crisis there, but I think one of the key things was that of course, they were scared about PS2, so they say to us explicitly, and also we ourselves, try to make Headhunter a game that is impossible to port to PS2. So we analyzed and tried to use everything that the Dreamcast was good at, that the PS2 was bad at. And more or less, when we are starting to get that in nail, Sega comes back to us and say, guys, can you port this to PS2?
So you had to kind of backtrack on all of these things that you'd done to make it difficult in order to then port it over?
Not really. It was just that, the porting, in the end, it shows that... and now I'm going to say that to all Dreamcast fans here, saying that the PS2 is a hell of a lot more powerful than Dreamcast, whatever people think it is. And of course, it was a bit harder to port it, but we still managed to do that rather well and quickly. That said, Dreamcast is an amazing machine in itself, and I'm very sad because, for sure, if it had lived longer, it would have produced, I would say, games with increased power and performance.
Well, I think that's everything. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. Really appreciate it. It's been a really great conversation. So thank you for sharing all of those anecdotes and stories. It's absolutely amazing to hear them all.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing us, for being a part of bringing us a game as good as Headhunter. Definitely appreciate it. Where can people find you if you want them to find you?
I actually am very disconnected. I don't have anything, I think, in social media apart my Instagram, but you will only find pictures of cat there. So I don't think that's the main thing. So I have actually not really been so much part into the gaming community and all. So it's more lately through Facebook and approaches by people of you that have been having a little interest. But I would say I have my Instagram, Our Blue, the Blue Hour. Again, just cats, but if somebody has any question about anything regarding Headhunter, of course they can ask me.
And I know you hang around the Dreamcast Junkyard Facebook group as well, don't you? Because that's how I kind of came across you. So I suppose people might find you there as well.
Of course. And like I said, that's the only thing where I keep a little of the nostalgia on some in this Facebook group. And sometimes I write some comments on a YouTube clip. Accidentally, I think most of the stuff I've been in fights about trying to explain that Dreamcast is awesome, but PlayStation 2 is also a good console. So it's interesting how, let's put it in these ways, a lot of people really feel strongly for their type of console.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's always the case, isn't it? But, you know, it's I definitely have never been one of those people who have stuck with one console. And as much as I was sad when the Dreamcast kind of came to an end, I did mourn it for a while. I got a PS2 fairly quickly afterwards, and the PS2 has some absolutely amazing games. You know, some of my favourite games are on the PS2. So I absolutely agree. It's... you know, the Dreamcast is great, but that doesn't mean that other consoles aren't, I suppose. No. So,
It's all about the games, I always say.
Yes, absolutely, definitely. Well, again, thank you very much for chatting to me. And yeah, take care. And yeah, look after yourself during the quarantine as well.
Yeah, like I said, take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Please stop this disc now. Now.